Whether it's because of an emotional breakup, a serious loss, or when their team wins the World Series, people will cry. All land animals produce tears, but only humans cry as an emotional response. On this week's Please Explain, we're taking a look at why weeping evolved in humans, and joining me now are Randy Cornelius, professor of psychology at Vassar College, and Tom Lutz, author of Crying, The Natural and Cultural History of Tears. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Randy, Charles Darwin once described a female elephant in the London Zoological Gardens who wept copious tears when she was separated from her calf. But don't contemporary scientists believe that humans are the only animals that cry as an emotional response?
It looks that way. You know, there are people who have made observations over the years of animals who tear. But it looks as if what's going on there is simply you have an animal that's injured or fatigued. And I actually think that's probably the origin of emotional tears, that when an animal is fatigued or injured and tears, other animals of its pack or troop or whatever will respond to it in a positive way. And I think there is the kernel of what's going on when we cry.
But it's surprising to me that other advanced social animals like chimpanzees and bonobos don't cry.
That's right. And, you know, partly what may be going on here is we simply don't have the data. You know, absence of data is not evidence of absence. And so we're not quite sure. But I would bet that human beings are different in this way.
Tom, you're a writer, not a scientist or a psychologist, but you've written a book about crying. What got you interested in the subject?
I come from an emotional family. we weep around the Thanksgiving dinner table, that kind of thing. So I thought it was normal until I got out into the wider world.
Well, overcooked turkeys will have that effect on a lot of people.
And my first book was on nervousness. I've been interested in emotion and the kind of history of emotion through my whole academic career as well.
So what is a tear made of?
Well, Randy probably can speak to this a little bit better, but it depends on whether you mean the basal tears, the kind of lubricating tears that keep our eyes moving in their sockets, or irritant tears.
So we have different kinds of tears? I didn't know that. I always thought that they were pretty much the same saline liquid.
Well, they're largely the same, but there's evidence that there are different levels of various hormones, for instance, in emotional tears than there are, and some different levels of minerals as well.
Randy, you want to add to that?
Well, Tom is talking about the experiments of a fellow named William Fry, he had people sniff a blender full of freshly blended onions or watch a sad film and collected their tears under those two conditions and chemically analyzed them and indeed found that they were different. And this gave rise and partially supported a theory that when we cry, one of the things we're doing is flushing out our system of the toxic byproducts of stress.
Tom, you write that crying is a form of elimination no different than urination.
Well, I think I may be talking about that theory at that moment. I think that a lot of psychologists don't find that argument, William Fry's, that convincing at this point.
Do animal tears have the same makeup as a human tear?
As far as we know, the basal tears do, but I don't know anyone, you know, because animals don't cry emotional tears, no one has done that experiment.
Mm.
Right. Well, it simply can't be done.
Right.
I throw this out to both of you. What is the current thinking as to why crying has evolved in humans? Is it a behavior like laughter that evolved for social reasons?
Well, Tom, do you want me to take this?
I think there's enough for both of us.
we probably both have a little different ideas on this, but mm-hmm. You know, I'm a social psychologist, and so my whole orientation is to look at what goes on between people. And for the past 20 years or so, I've been looking at the ways in which crying has evolved to signal our distress to others. And it's pretty clear that tears have a very specific signal function, and they signal, I'm in need, help me.
But I have had the experience more than once of watching a film alone and mm-hmm. being moved by it, and tears start rolling down my eye. Nobody's around.
Exactly. Well, it turns out that's probably more true for men. You know, many of us cry more often when we're alone, but we're talking about two different kinds of situations. You know, if we look at how crying evolved, you know, the tear system came into being to have this signal function. But we can also cry when we're alone because the elicitors are still there. But, you know, if you look at what people want to do when they see another person crying, they want to comfort that person, and that sort of completes the circle.
So it's a form of communication, and I guess I should assume that it evolved before language.
Well, probably.
For the individual, it does, certainly. Mm-hmm. Right?
Because babies cry a lot because they don't have language. That's the way they tell us that they are distressed.
Exactly.
They need some attention.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that fascinated me the whole time I was studying tears is that all emotional systems are so complex. There are so many different parts of an emotional response. There are lots of different brain centers involved. There's lots of hormonal activity, lots of sympathetic nervous system, parasympathetic nervous system. There's just so much going on. And each researcher who has tried to explain why we cry has tapped into that system in a different place, mm-hmm. or from, as in Randy's case, from a kind of social, psychological, experimental way. There's lots of it's so complicated that you can't. All you can do is you can say, well, this is part of the picture. This is part of the puzzle as well. You can't really come down as one evolutionary psychologist did and say, well, we as early humans, we were living in caves with fires. When we invented fire, we needed big tear ducts to keep the cinders out of our mm-hmm. making us go blind, and that explains why humans cry and other animals don't, because we had fires in caves. Now that may actually be true, but it doesn't go very far in explaining why we cry at sad films. It doesn't go very far in explaining why we cry at when we win the World Series.
So it's really odd that this is so basic to the human experience, and we know still so little about why we do it. We probably don't know whether crying changes when, what the transition is from baby crying to kid crying, because kids who can talk still cry an awful lot more than adults do. Is this a socialization thing, or does crying serve different functions for children and adults?
Well, you know, I think there we have a real absence of information. My colleague Deborah Zeifman here in the psych department at Vassar studies infant crying and has speculated a little bit about that transition from infancy to childhood into adolescence. But we just don't have a lot of information. We do know that the big gender difference in crying happens during the early school years, and so it looks as if there's probably a socialization effect going on there.
And yet, a study showed that 90% of all men cry at the ending of the movie Field of Dreams.
Yes.
Well, boy, what pathetic things we are.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is funny the kind of the humor quotient in this as well, right? That we crying is loaded. It's as Randy says, it's a form of distress signaling, and so.
And sometimes it could be used as a manipulative thing. You know, tears start coming out of your eyes because you're upset about something, but you want to be sure that you're seen,
mm-hmm.
especially by the person who has caused you to cry.
Absolutely, and men and women both can use tears as kind of dishonest signals as well as honest signals.
Well, and you know, just to support something that Tom was saying earlier, this system is so complex that you know sometimes we're using tears and not even aware of it. That is, we can be manipulative and not even know that we're being manipulative, and that's actually the most effective form of manipulation, because we appear so sincere when we're doing it.
Uh-huh, but actually, there are complex psychological reasons for those tears.
Yes.
Very complex, and it seems to me that that tears are much more likely to occur when we have mixed emotions than when we have very, very clear, easily. Mm. And there's some evidence, for instance, that infants who are severely neglected, kind of left alone in a crib for weeks at a time, stop producing tears. And we all know that the infant that starts going wah 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 and is not producing any tears because it's so sure that it's going to be responded to immediately that it doesn't have to actually cry. And it's the infant that's a little bit afraid that it's not going to get taken care of, that its needs aren't going to be met, and yet is fairly confident that they are. That kind of mixture of expectancy and fear.
My guests are Tom Lutz, author of Crying, The Natural and Cultural History of Tears, and Randy Cornelius, professor of psychology at Vassar College. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and in a little while we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. A listener left us a little message saying that he cries out of frustration.
There are many, many emotions that seem to elicit tears, and you were asking a little while ago, wondering why, you know, this being such a basic form of human expression, why we don't know more about it. Part of that answer is because crying occurs in such a wide spectrum of emotions. And the other part of it, of course, is that it's very difficult to capture crying as an experimental scientist. That is, it's hard to get people to cry in the laboratory. Some people do.
Well, actors can do it.
Actors can do it, that's right. And one of the first people I interviewed when I got interested in crying was a student actor who showed me how he could cry. And I said, well, how do you do it? And he says, I don't know, but here, I'll do it for you. And he began crying.
Yeah, I had the same experience, an actor who could just actually produce tears within seconds.
Yes.
Now, is this also a culturally linked thing? For example, in this country, women cry more than men because male crying is frowned upon. In the Iliad, Achilles seems to be crying all the time, and he is the embodiment of maleness.
All the great warrior heroes wept. Odysseus wept. Of course, Jesus wept. But all the El Cid wept. Roland wept.
Which gives us a sense of them as being larger than life characters.
Well, I think you're right that it's because there are cultural differences involved. Although you know Schwarzkopf wept and Lincoln wept and Grant
and Rudy
wept.
Giuliani, right? And see,
sure.
So you know there is a form of male crying that is linked with sort of heroicism and strength. You know, we often do think of crying as a signal of vulnerability, and sometimes you know people are denigrated. Men, especially in the past, have been denigrated for that. But there's a whole other side to this, and the kind of people that Tom is talking about illustrates this really nicely.
Well, Rudy Giuliani only cries when his cell phone rings at inappropriate moments.
But that's the frustration.
We've been circling around this whole thing about tears of happiness, tears of joy, tears of mourning. Bob Dylan sang tears of rage.
Mm-hmm.
We tear at all sorts of different kinds of stimulations.
Mm-hmm.
An athlete will cry after an important victory. Fans will cry after their team wins a major sporting event.
Yeah, you know, Darwin claimed that it was cultural, that if we had grown up learning to laugh at a funeral, we would laugh at a funeral. These expressions are completely arbitrary and learned. And there's a lot of evidence that, for instance, there are cultures in which the men weep on the way to the gravesite as they're burying a loved one, and the women weep on the way home, and they don't. Not vice versa. There's an interesting experiment about Maori kids who come from New Zealand and go to prep school in England, and go home, and they can no longer cry at the right time in their rituals.
Those British schools.
Yeah, exactly.
But so many people will tell you
there's a lot of evidence that that culture does determine when we find crying appropriate.
Many people will tell you that crying is therapeutic.
Mm-hmm. Is well, you know, my idea as a social psychologist is, and again, you know, to echo something that Tom was saying, this is one side of a complex issue. But for me, part of why crying is therapeutic is precisely because it draws others to us. Now, we can have a good cry when we're alone, certainly, and I think there are some physiological things going on there. But to the extent that crying draws other people to us who are going to comfort us, it has a kind of social therapeutic aspect to it.
So we've been talking largely about why we cry, but we haven't been talking about the response of others when they see us cry.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
Have studies been done on that?
There's been a lot less study about that. Mm-hmm. I think that's clear. That's easy to say. But to go back to Randy's point for a minute, I do think that since crying is a fundamental form of human communication, people who can't cry are missing out on mm-hmm. some very important ways in which we can interact with each other. And therefore, to be able to cry has some kind of basic therapeutic advantage. Mm-hmm. But the idea that we can cry ourselves to mental health in any other sort of way as a kind of technique, as a technology of therapy, I think is wrongheaded. And if it were true, then actors who cry on stage every night would be the most psychologically healthy people.
Or teenagers.
And I think that, yeah, I think there's good evidence that that's not true. I live in Los Angeles. It's simply not true.
Well, we also cry selectively in most cases. For example, we're more likely to cry if we see a dog hit by a car mm-hmm. than if we're told that 800,000 people were mm-hmm. killed in the Rwandan genocide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although some people certainly do cry when they hear news of that sort. But there is something about, you know, events being directly perceived that brings our tears. And, you know, that's something I've pondered, and I don't really have an answer to it. You know, reading a Hallmark card or seeing, you know, the old reach out and touch someone commercial. And, you know, why do those things touch us so deeply when reading about Rwandan refugees doesn't sometimes?
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take some listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. My guests are Randy Cornelius, professor of psychology at Vassar College, Tom Lutz, who's written a book about crying called Crying, The Natural and Cultural History of Tears. Our number again, 212-433-9692.
Now you say cry the long night through. Well, you can cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you.
Everybody knows where you go when the sun goes down. I think you only live to see the lights of town. I wasted my time when I would try. When the lights have lost the glow, you're gonna cry.
We're back with Randy Cornelius, professor of psychology at Vassar College, Tom Lutz, author of Crying, The Natural and Cultural History of Tears. We're talking about crying on today's Please Explain. Explaining as much as we know about crying. Amazingly, we know less than I would have ever have thought, and it's bringing tears to my eyes of frustration. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Janine from, is it Teaneck, New Jersey?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, your discussion is very interesting. First of all, I'd like to say hello to Professor Cornelius. I'm a Vassar class of 87, so
how about that?
Shout out to VC. My question is, because my nickname from my fiance is Waterworks. I burst into tears, you know, mostly happy tears, mm-hmm. at commercials, the end of a movie, you know, when my child wins a basketball game, all the time. It's not a means of communication, as you were discussing earlier, and it certainly would happen if I were by myself or trying to communicate with other people. But I'm wondering if you have ever done any studies trying to figure out why certain people have the propensity to cry and other people could go to, you know, a funeral and stand there stone-faced. Is there some chemical link or, you know, something that you figured out about people who cry a lot that's different from people who never do?
Or more efficient tear ducts.
it could be that. there has been some work looking at personality differences of people who cry versus those who don't cry. And there are sort of momentary sort of things, shorter term things like feeling sad or depressed and whatnot. But one of the most interesting differences between those who cry a lot and those who don't is that people who cry a lot have sort of more, it's called ego strength. So sort of more positive sense of themselves, paradoxically. And I think, you know, that might be reflected in what you're saying, that you cry a lot out of for positive things. And in the way I think about crying, when we cry in response to the sorts of things you're describing, it's reaffirming our bonds with others. And, you know, crying also communicates something to ourselves.
So, Janine, you're a healthy person.
That's good.
So thank you.
I shouldn't get teased anymore.
Yeah, tell him he screwed up. If he was a little healthier, he'd cry a lot more.
He's probably listening right now, and he's probably going to kill me later, and then I'll be crying for a different reason. But thanks, guys.
Thank you for calling us. Barbara from Roslyn.
Hi. I was 12 years old, and the first time I ever saw a man cry was when I saw my father crying at night. I walked in on him unexpectedly. He was in the dining room. My mother was in the hospital, very, very sick, and I saw that he was crying, and it upset me, I think, even more than the fact that I was upset about my mother being sick. I was so embarrassed. I just turned and fled. I couldn't watch it. It was very upsetting.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about this, or...?
Yeah, well, I guess there's a couple things right away. One is that when did this happen?
I was 12
Barbara?
Years old, and I had never seen a man cry before. And my image of my father was always a very strong, mm-hmm. capable, and he was.
So it hurt you to see him being so vulnerable?
Absolutely, it was awful.
Again, since it's in our culture and in most cultures, the kind of emotional expression, we have different jobs as expressive people based on whether we are men or women, adults or children, fathers or daughters, and different kind of expectations come along with those roles. And when we act outside of our role, outside the norm of our role, it's significant. So when a man cries in front of his children, that's a very different kind of event than when a child cries in front of its parents, just necessarily. And that's going to be true in every culture in different ways. So I'm not at all surprised that this was a very important and significant event for you. And especially if this happened many years ago, is this a...
No, until today, listening to your fascinating discussion, I hadn't thought about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, seeing a parent cry, especially a male parent, can be very emotionally overwhelming for a child. And, you know, as Tom was saying, our parents, especially our fathers in our culture, are supposed to be strong and protecting, right? And to see someone feeling that vulnerable is scary.
Yeah, it really was. And my father especially, he was, my mother couldn't handle sick children, so... When I was sick, he was the caregiver, and I always thought of him as this fantastically emotionally strong person, and it was quite overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Now it's important to remember too, though, that this kind of idea or ideal we have of male reticence is a very recent and kind of a blip on the historical screen. In the 18th century, men wept volubly and in public. Thomas Jefferson said there's no greater pleasure in the world than to weep with a lover. Men were expected to cry at the theater, cry in the home, cry because they were happy with their children. In the 19th century, Lincoln and Douglas wept as they debated each other. It was just normal, and the idea that in the 20th century, we came to understand that the father of the house doesn't cry in front of his.
Although there were exceptions. Remember, Johnny Ray said, "If a sweetheart sends a letter of goodbye, you'll feel better if you cry."
Oh, absolutely. And Spencer Tracy says, you know, in relation to Janine Waterworks earlier, Spencer Tracy said, you know, we men can do it too. We just don't think about it as often.
Right. Peter from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard, how you doing?
Okay.
Good. I'm a pretty sensitive guy. I of course cry at the end of Field of Dreams and Rudy and all those movies. I certainly cry a lot when I watch Extreme Makeover Home Edition when they consistently every time on what my wife and I call the Oh My God show, because the family's always like, oh my God, you know.
Right.
However, when I'm hungover in the morning on a Sunday or whatnot, I find I am so, I mean, I could cry watching Tim Russert on Meet the Press. I get sensitive when I am hungover, and it is, I don't understand it. It's shocking to me.
But, you know, Tim Russert has that effect on me as well, and I'm not hungover.
For different reasons, yeah. Randy, this is something I know no research about.
Well, you know, my guess is that like all emotional expressions, there are thresholds to crying, and the thresholds are influenced by our physiological state. One of the situations in which we tend to cry more is when we're exhausted, and what happens is, you know, our threshold levels are so lowered because of all the stress hormones in our bodies. And my guess is something like that was going on when you were hungover. And, you know, one of the things alcohol does is it serves as a disinhibitor. And the inhibition is all in our frontal lobes, and alcohol does a good job of knocking those out.
Thank you so much for your call, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
Marilyn from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Many years ago, for years, I was a good crier. I was able to cry, and now I'm a mature person, and it's been many years since I've been able to cry, and I miss it. How can I help myself to cry again?
Well, you know, there are a number of changes that happen to us as we get older, hormonal changes and whatnot, that definitely seem to influence how easy it is for us to cry. And I know some people who have dealt with that by buying artificial tears, and when they feel like crying, they'll flush their eyes with those, and the sensation of those tears running down their cheeks will satisfy them. I've known other people that sort of, a la the researcher who made people sniff onions, have done just that, blended up some onions or chopped them up. And, you know, the irritant tears there feels like those good old tears that we cry when we're at a weepy movie or something.
Now, Marilyn, if you were a man, you could watch Field of Dreams.
I have heard, so someone told me that in England there are crying clubs, and people get together to watch weepy movies. And, you know, it's with a bunch of good friends, and you feel safe doing that, and the tears flow more easily then.
You know, there was one movie that moved me to tears even recently, is Cinema Paradiso.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, for some reason, that film made me cry.
It was the subtitles. Thank you for calling us. My guests are Tom Lutz, author of Crying, The Natural and Cultural History of Tears, and Randy Cornelius, professor of psychology at Vassar College. We're talking about crying on today's Please Explain. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Amy from Harrington Park, New Jersey. You're on the air.
Hi. My experience was my mother was a big crier, and I always sort of, you know, looked down on her a little bit, and I thought of myself as quite a tough character. I didn't cry at movies. And then I had a kid, and it was like that opened the gate or something, and now I cried about Dr. King this morning. I mean, you know.
Well, I would guess that this is the hormonal thing that we were talking about earlier. Wouldn't you say that it would be a reason?
You know, I think that,
12.
That's part of it. that's certainly part of it for mothers. But, you know, when I had kids, my first child, I started crying much more. And part of it was the world seemed like a much more dangerous place.
Yeah.
And, you know, my tears had to do with my son being safe or imperiled or whatever. So there's a psychological aspect to it, I think, as well as a physiological.
And also, you're hearing a lot of crying, aren't you?
Yeah, well,
do you think crying
little.
Prompts crying?
Because
laughter
and
definitely
contagious.
Prompts laughter.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that might have been the case long ago, but my kid is 12 now, and it still goes on, so it must be more than... I can't be just so physiological. I think it must be partly that feeling of vulnerability you get when you're a parent.
That's definitely the case.
One of the things that I noticed, you know, and so much crying research has taken place through watching people watch films, mm-hmm. Or collecting tears while they watch weepy films. And in the films that people have used for experiments, I found that over and over again, the flash point for tears, the moment when we weep at a film, is a moment of role fulfillment. Mm-hmm. When the prodigal son comes home, when the drunkard father finally kind of gets his act together, when the terrible mother finally acts affectionate, when the bad daughter comes home. Those are moments in which the social role is being fulfilled in an important way, and those are moments in which we all kind of get together and weep. And one of the things about being a parent is that you're thinking about your own role, social role, in important ways on a daily basis. And I think that leads us to kind of have these moments of realization that we are either fulfilling our role well or fulfilling it really badly.
Now, we've been talking about crying as tears coming out of your eyes, but crying also often has sounds attached to it. With kids, the sound seems to be as important as the tears, and parents will recognize their kids cry in a playground of 300 kids.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes adults, sounds come out, whether you want them to or not. Other times they don't. Has anybody talked about the links between the sounds and the tears?
Well, you know, what seems to be distinctive about adult crying is the tearing aspect of it. And so the sounds of crying of adults have gotten much less, have received much less interest. There's a lot of research on you know, the auditory aspects of infant crying especially, and you can distinguish different states in infants by characteristics of their cries. But we haven't really looked at that in adults yet, and it would actually be easier to study than the tears.
Mm.
You just get out a tape recorder.
We also could, it would be interesting to find out why some people want to be comforted when they cry, at least sometimes, and then other times they say, no, leave me alone.
That's right. Mm. Men are very likely to do that, and then really want to be comforted.
You mean they're lying?
Yes.
I think that it's also true that tears themselves are such as Randy said it's a signaling device, and they're such a significant signal that we don't really need to vocalize our cry in order to have the effect that tears can have. So when Hillary Clinton kind of just welled up a little bit in back in Vermont, was it? During the primary,
it was in New Hampshire.
She, you know, that was big news, and she didn't even let a tear drop, right? So, whereas the kind of ululation or the moaning and wailing at a Middle Eastern funeral, for instance, there are cultures in which that is also a norm. But the tear itself is so powerful that it's not always necessary.
We have very little time, but I've put Janet from Greenwich, Connecticut on. Janet, can you make it very quick?
Yes, I can make it very quick. My father was in a nursing home for 12 years. I adored him. He was a Parkinson's disease victim. And I remember one day my husband and I visited on his birthday, and I had bought him a pair of slippers, hoping that they would fit right from what I knew. And I slipped them on his feet, and they fit perfectly. He was sitting in a wheelchair, and he started to cry. and I felt like I was going to die. And my husband said, let's leave now. The best thing is let's leave. And I listened to him, and to this day I regret that decision.
But what is the question? Did the elderly cry more easily than people in middle age? I'm not asking her. Do you know the answer? Because we've really run out of time.
Well, it's there are longer answers to that, but not very good short ones.
Oh, well. Maybe we'll have to do this again.
I hope so.
That would be great.
And I want to thank you so much for being with us, both of you, for today's Please Explain, which we looked at crying. Randy Cornelius, who is professor of psychology at Vassar College and who studies crying, and Tom Lutz, who wrote a book about crying called Crying, the Natural and Cultural History of Tears. Who publishes that book, Tom?
That's Norton.
And it's been a real pleasure talking with you, and I'm not going to make a joke about getting teary-eyed because I'm actually as dry-eyed as I've ever been in my life.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
On Monday's show, theoretical physicist Michio Kaku explains how recent scientific advances could make the impossible possible, things like telepathy and time travel. Also, Stephen Merrill Block's debut novel, Isabel Allende, on her second memoir, The Sum of Our Days, and leading Nicaraguan writer and former vice president Sergio Ramirez talks about the complicated history of his country. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Julia Corcoran, Barbara Kahn, and John Cottrell. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We will see you on Monday.